Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love, and you are listening to the first episode from 2016 of Vodka O'Clock. And joining me on this fine day, I hope it is, I don't know, it's kind of gloomy here, is Josh Stallings. And he's been on the show before, and, you know, he's an awesome writer, and we're going to talk about writerly things and life things, because he's wonderful to just pick his brain, so... that's what this is going to be all about. So don't forget that you can sponsor the show at patreon.com/AmberUnmasked. Hey, Josh, how are you?
I'm good. It's a little early for Vodka O'Clock, but okay.
Yeah.
Never too early, is it, really?
It's, you know, I don't buy into the whole time of day thing.
It is always Vodka O'Clock somewhere in the world, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I can eat. People give me weird looks if I want to eat dinner at breakfast time. Like, I don't care.
Why do people, everybody understands breakfast for lunch. They don't understand dinner for breakfast. Why is that?
I don't know.
Okay.
But I'm okay. If I'm like really hungry, forget it. I might want like, you know, leftovers for breakfast.
Yum.
So I'm reading Young Americans right now. And this is my favorite thing that you've done.
It is a weird experience I'm having in that. This is going to sound strange. I don't mean to be, because there's a lot of people loving it, giving it, like, people that I really respect saying it's the best thing I've written. And to me, it was a palate cleanser. It was like sorbet.
Right. And that's,
the Moses, you know, books were so fucking hard and dark, you know?
Right. They were hard to read, too. I mean, it's...
yeah.
So I can imagine how, okay, the Moses books were, it's a trilogy, and then you had your memoir, which I have not read yet, so it's on my Amazon wish list, people. So you've got these four books that tackle some dark subjects and life of crime, but, you know, life, you know, on the fringe of sex work and drugs and guns and... all this deep, dark, gritty stuff. So in that four-book span, how many years was that of your life that was dedicated to living in that dark headspace?
A book a year concentrated, but the first book was Beautiful, Naked, and Dead was really about 3 years in the writing because it wasn't good enough. And it's something I feel about, like, one of the problems with the digital revolution is people are publishing their first books long before they should. And I did it a different way. I got to be friends with Charlie Houston and with Tad Williams, who I grew up with, writers I really respected, and let them beat the shit out of me till I got it right. And so I didn't put anything out until I really believed in it. So that first one took a while. They get faster. I'm at about a book a year, and that's with a hard day job as well.
Okay. But, so what's, is the day job connected to publishing?
No, the day job is I edit movie trailers.
Oh, okay. Right.
I've been doing that since 21. I've had two jobs. I've worked as a writer and a script doctor, and I've edited movie trailers. That's how I supported my family. And I got married very young and had kids young. And just, so I've been knocking out the bills since I was 21. Banging them out, as we say.
Wow.
But I've been really lucky in that. This is just a sidebar. My father passed away last year, and before he passed away, he was an artist and a freak and a bunch of other things. And I loved him, but he was hard, and it was all kinds of things. But we made peace when he passed because I had about 6 months where I was up there quite often hanging out. And what I realized is having an artist for a dad has all these negative sides to it because they can be flaky and he's self-absorbed, but the way my brain's wired, if I didn't know you could do creative for a living, I would have been screwed. I'm so dyslexic. My brain just works in such a way that if I hadn't discovered that I could make a living in editing or some other creative form, I really would have been dead. It's either that or digging ditches, and I'm not kidding. Like, those are the only things I'm kind of fit for. Is I'm big, so I could do physical labor. I've always been able to do that. So I could either be a laborer digging ditches or something creative, and not much in between. I was
right.
Never going to be white collar. Just wasn't built
yeah.
that way.
So that's, I didn't realize that your dad had passed away. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But you do have in your characters, you do have these interesting relationships where either there's like not a dad in the picture, or it's kind of like much younger girls with kind of older guys
Yeah.
happening, you know,
That's
so you sort of feel that absence.
there is I th like when I sat down to write Young Americans, I decided to not write about my family. So I did some things kind of on purpose to, like, I was raised Quaker. I made a decision at the beginning to make them a Jewish family, just to sort of separate in people's minds. So many people think I'm Moses that I said, I want to write a book that doesn't look and feel like it's about me. Because I'm no more Moses than everything is me, but everything's also not me. And I really consciously took that world and said, I'm going to step away from my own. And the truth is, at the end of the day, it's as much about my life as anything I've ever fucking written.
Well, it's very much about family, but not only the main character Sam's family, but also the family that she has invented. And that's
Yes.
really big to me. It's really big to a lot of other people that feel like misfit toys.
Good term. Misfit toys, aren't we? Yes.
We just are, you know. I pick my. That's why, I love the conventions and things, even though they're kind of hard for me to tolerate now. But I love going and seeing people, and you just get to you get your band of merry men together, and it's that's your family.
It's Andrew Vox, who I loved a lot when I was younger, read him a lot. He's one of those other writers I just adored. And there's certainly pieces of him in the Moses stories. You can see them. I tend to put things in obvious ways when I'm stealing them from authors I love. But one of the things that he really brought up in is the idea of the family of your choosing. He wrote about broken people who build their own families. And this idea that you build your own family, it isn't necessary blood. And sometimes blood is a barrier between family, where finding your own family of choosing is something you can actually build the right one, the one you wished you had.
It's really true. And in fact, a friend of mine, Elsa Henry, who's been on the show a couple of times before, she hosted Friendsgiving instead of, Thanksgiving.
Love.
She's just, she's like, whoever is around and doesn't have a place and wants to come hang out with, with her and her husband and their animals, was invited to just, go and do their feasting.
That's beautiful.
And that's like so cool. It's like I usually, if I'm, I mean, it's just like me and my folks, and so now there's another person added to the picture, and other than it's still pretty small. So I, even if I was alone, I spent time online. It was amazing how many people would just still just be on Twitter. Like, hello, other people that don't feel like talking to actual family.
Okay. I noticed at Christmas and at Twitter, people are around. I mean, at Thanksgiving. But last night when Star Wars opened, social
Nobody.
media was dead. Maybe that says more about my friend circle than anything else.
I turned it off because I'm like, every single person I know is at the movies right now. I'm just gonna watch a bunch of 30 Rock episodes on Netflix.
Netflix, okay. River.
Yes, been watching it. I'm like 3 or 4 in.
Oh my God.
Yeah, weird.
There's a thing that they do. It's in Stuart Neville's Ghost of Belfast. Is there's this sort of, it's like, magic realism that comes out of South and Central America. It's kind of like that. There's Celtic magic realism that Stuart deals with in his books, which is a IRA hitman who's haunted by the ghosts of people he's killed. And you never quite know in that whether they're real or whether he's crazy. He like just walks that line where they do, we don't as American writers deal with it that way, but because we seem to feel the need to define things. But it's been like a real, it's been in South American writing forever, as in Latin writing, this idea that, well, some things may or may not be real. Magic doesn't always need to be defined.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, it's cool. It's there's. I want to try and get to it. It's something I look at things in a new book and go, I want to try and figure out how to get to there. I wrote a short story that gets pretty close. It's about mental illness, but it's like something about it. I just go, that's really cool, because the world feels that way to me. It feels much less solid than it looks.
Yeah, when I try talking about that to specific certain groups of people, either they seem like you need to embrace some kind of religion or that you're anti-science.
Yes, and
And I'm like, why is there an either or?
I love the there was two people from the it's like the National College of Scientists anyway, if there's some term like that, when they were being asked by Congress about creationism. And they said, here's the problem, is that they said, we don't have an opinion on spirituality or religion. It's just in a different realm than science and shouldn't be taught in the same room. And I thought that was really a respectful way to look at that and go, yeah, there's some things that aren't science. And that just because something can't be proven with science doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Because we all know things that we know exist. I have friends that I know when they're going through a hard time and they're 500 miles away from me. And I will call them and they'll say, God, I need to talk to you. Well, science doesn't know why that happens. They'll say, oh, that's coincidence. Well, it happens enough that all of us know that feeling to go, yeah, or we're connected deeper than you can measure.
It's I don't I totally am there with you on that. And I did not get to have the joys of growing up in hippy dippy California.
Oh, it was joyous. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, reading through Young Americans and the setting is so much an important part of the book. You set it in the 70s, and the 70s here, well, at least my 70s, I was pretty sheltered, was really, it was so different. I mean, you talk about the clubs and the fashion in great detail, and it's so funny because it was like the as well as I knew you and still didn't know enough, the way that there was so much discussion about David Bowie and stuff, I'm thinking, wow, I totally pegged him for like a thorough good guy. Like I was just so surprised reading, like the interviews on with Elizabeth White on her post and other interviews that you've done, how you talked about having those skinny tight pants and going commando and wearing your silk shirts that were shiny
Oh
and.
my God, we were glitter kids. A term which is I've discovered controversial because a lot of people use the term glam for glam rock. I never liked the term because it sounded cheesy to me, and I was into glitter rock, not glam rock. It turns out they're the same thing, just regional. But no, I dedicated this book to Tad Williams, the fantasy writer. He and I grew up in this world together. We were teenagers together, running in this world, and to be around brilliant people who are really smart and thinking and doing music and into this wild counterculture scene that people think punk is tough because it's all angry. Man, what really scared people was like David Bowie and bisexuality freaked the fuck out of people. Even the hippies
Oh,
got
I'm
freaked
sure.
out by his sexuality and by a culture that said, yeah, you're into free love. We're into love everyone, regardless of gender. And that just sort of like, I think it's a much stronger statement than the punk statement of I'm angry,
Well, I think pansexuality is feared in
You think?
to an extent because I mean, yeah, it's I mean, a lot of people they're kind of cool with gay men to a degree, or they're way more cooler with lesbians, but they're okay saying, okay, yeah, I liked Freddie Mercury because he was this gay man, and they completely erase the fact that he was bi or probably pansexual, because now we say pan to include anybody, but
It's the opening quote of my book is from David Bowie, and one of it is about how much bisexual, I won't lie, but bisexual has been great for my career. Besides, it's a lot of fun. And I thought, because I really, okay, I'm also a contrarian, and I had somebody I respect a lot, an agent who I respect a lot, tell me two things. She said, A, you can't make a heist novel that's also a coming of age novel. Those two don't cross over. And then she said, and I don't think people really care who's fucking who, meaning gay, straight, all of that. So I immediately picked a quote right away to say, no, this is actually about who's fucking who. And I delivered a book that is a coming of age story. And
I
it's
think it's
hard.
perfectly fine because when you talk about other coming of age stories where, or if it's not like a coming of age, like if that's not the main theme, but you're talking about a YA story and you're putting younger characters through some kind of series of challenges, among those challenges is usually some discovery of sexuality. I mean, and it's usually, and the, I mean, talking about a heist, it's there's usually things like, hey, we have to go steal this from Farmer Ted in order to make the widget work and get out into our portal and go back to our world. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I
So there's.
intentionally look at this as a YA novel. That sounds
Yeah,
odd, but
I
I do.
totally get that feel.
I
And I mean, think about like Lord of the Rings is a heist
Yes, it
book.
is. And To Kill a Mockingbird is a coming-of-age crime story. And the
Yeah.
best books we like cross over genre in a way that surprises us, not the way that we. Publishing has gotten to a place right now that I feel very strong that what it's about is how do you trying to convince writers to write something that they already know how to sell, as opposed to trying to figure out how to sell something they haven't seen before. And that's the ones I'm interested in writing. I'm not interested in writing something they already have written. Why would I do that? It's been written. I'm interested in crossing over into something that isn't out there yet.
I think this would be, I mean, so far, I think I'm on chapter 8 or 9 right now. This would be absolutely enjoyable for teen plus readers,
I've,
you know, like higher teens. Like, I'm not going to
yeah.
give this to a 13-year-old, but, you know, truly a 16-year-old, 17-year-old in high school, this would be fine.
I've actually, I work with teenagers at the Unitarian Church. I did in the past, and one of my students just sent me a photograph of her holding my book, and I was so proud because it's the first thing I've written that I think that teenagers should read. That I think is it's there's nothing, and I don't think that's about content for me. It's about darkness of story. There's a certain
Well,
darkness of the Moses that I don't want to feed into teen angst, and this has a
right. The
lightness of story.
you handle the characters in Young Americans so differently. Like the main character, Samantha, is a stripper. Your main characters in the other books, besides Moses, I mean, but the girls he's with are strippers and sex workers. And then there are, you know, the victims of trafficking, which is totally different. But the consensual wanting to be there, you know, to earn their pay as strippers, I'm talking about. So you've got these women, and they have the same job in two vastly different presentations.
And she is Sam is nobody's victim, and she's nobody's. I purposely wrote the first scenes before you discover she's a stripper. You discover she's a badass who kicks her boyfriend's ass, so that you really get to know her, going through her in a different way than the Moses books. Actually, are in the trilogy start with a wounded little girl and end with him being with a woman of his own age, slightly older, who's an assassin. It's really this three book trilogy that gets you to the phases of who women can be, and goes ultimately Moses gets smart enough to go, I think I'll go with the ass kicker. But it's less a statement on what strippers are and more a statement on what I was trying to look at in those books of this sort of growth of womanhood. And the covers of those books are even that. They show this growth of womanhood.
Right, I noticed the cha well the covers. Well, it's so funny that you bring up the covers, because your books have that dark, gritty and sexual content and sexual violence and just the whole presence of violence, because it's a real hard-boiled crime book. But the covers of your books, did you see the new Ghostbusters posters yesterday?
No. Oh, I can't
Okay,
wait.
so the new, like, all female Ghostbusters posters came out, and to me they looked like they were sci-fi version of like bondage erotica. I
Oh,
mean, I'm like, they were recolored and like to make them all black except for spot coloring on like the logo, or the spot coloring on the, you know, whatever weapon they're holding or something like that, the proton packs and stuff. And like the Melissa McCarthy one, she's holding this proton pack, but it's zoomed in so close that all you see is like the barrel of the thing, and it just looks like this big sci-fi dildo.
oh, God.
And the rest of the picture is black, and like black, just dark shades of gray. Their outfits, which you know are tan, look like black leather. I'm like, who is the fucking designer that made these posters where they all look like covers of crime or BDSM erotica? Like, who
Well,
did these covers?
here's the
These covers.
truth, okay? Because I work in posters and in trailers. The company I'm in has does both. for posters, they hand in, we usually hand in 1,100, 2,000 comps before they pick one. So it isn't who designed it, it's which studio guy chose it, right?
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
It's like whoever designed it was just trying to get a paycheck, but they did. I think of Ghostbusters, I love the original, and what I think of Ghostbusters is it's white and red. That's Ghostbusters. It isn't black and moody. It's white and red. It's comedy. It's light.
Yeah, that's not what they did. They tried to make these into like sexy book cover pictures.
Which is, I was afraid I was going to lose my noir audience when I wrote and put out Young Americans. I really, because it's so not what noir is, and I was getting sick of where noir was. I was tired of all the darkness around me. I feel my life has got enough darkness in it. I've had some real personal stuff that's very dark, and I've had enough. And there's a guy, Eric Buettner, who I love and has written, I don't know, 14 damn noir books and runs Noir Bar out here. And he's kind of like one of those guys. He reads more than anyone I know. He's super deep into noir. And Young Americans is on his best of the year list, and he said is the most fun I've had this year reading a book. And I thought, if I can get you, I think I can get the rest of y'all. We're
Yeah,
all a little
really.
tired of dark. Like, the world's dark enough. Let's lighten it up a little, kids.
Yeah, I mean, and and that's all the different ways that we consume crime fiction. I mean, on TV, there's you can have something as silly as Castle or Psych, versus something like Criminal Minds and CSI.
Yeah, and everything in between. And it's not that I don't appreciate dark. Hell, I love Ken Brown. Of course I like dark. I like a lot of these writers. But I also want to make sure that we as a community have a bigger tool chest than that. That we have a tool chest that allows for comedy, that allows for lightness of heart, that allows to, because I don't want all one thing. I like the flavors.
Yeah, and that's, I know that you were re really specific in choosing the cover artist for Young
Oh my
Americans and
God.
how, it's like took some convincing and everything, but you can see it's like this is going to be something different. It's bright neon pink with, like the disco ball and that old font.
Oh,
The font was amazing.
this guy Chung Kong, who's a Dutch artist who I did, he does by day he has another name and he does advertising like I do. And at night he does reimagined movie posters, and they're just stunning. And what I fell in love with, the site DeviantArt.
Sure, yeah.
I used that to try and find an artist, and that and a couple others. I was just searching. I knew the look I wanted, and couldn't quite articulate it till I saw his work. And he does icons in a way like he could boil something down to a very simple icon that I would go, "Oh, that you nailed that." So after convincing him. And it took some doing to do a book cover because he didn't do them. He didn't do commissions. And getting him to do this cover, I pretty much gave him free rein. I said, here's the story. I pitched him on. He said, well, that's interesting. Let me take a run at that. I said, and the only thing I can tell you is I'm known as a noir writer and I need something different. You figure out what the hell that means. And he came back with that color palette and it blew my fucking mind. It looks so good in a bookstore. I look at a bookstore and that book pops.
It really does. Well, that's why I love cozy mystery covers because they've gone through changes. They used to be so, like more like solid colors like that with really bright, very bold, letters. A lot of the letters on the old paperbacks were raised. You could feel like the embossing. And if there was an image or graphic, it was something reasonably small. And now it's changed. Because these are trends. This is why I would make the mistake and I would buy the same book over and over again because they would change the cover and I'd go to the store and forget and buy it. But so now everything is cartoons. So the cover of the cozy mystery section, you'll see much more pastel colors
Interesting.
and curly, like very curvy fonts and or bold, they could be serif sans serif fonts too. And the but the if there's a picture, a figure of a woman or a figure of a dog or a dog sitting in a window looking at flowers or something, it's all very cartoony now. So I was lucky and no cartoonist, so I went to one of them and I said, I need a book cover. And I was like, here, I made a Pinterest board of just cozy covers for samples, and I was like, here, I know you can do this,
Oh, that's.
and by the way, it's about murder.
I am so intrigued by this idea that what you're doing kind of blows my mind in a good way. I jokingly, a couple of years ago, tried to convince my little sister, who's also a writer, that she and I should start writing zombie cozies.
And oh, sure.
I thought zombie cozy would be good. And then we got from there to Viking cozies, which I think is really the big one.
That does sound perfect for you. I know I've read a couple magical ones and vampire ones. There's a real funny vampire series where she just like, she doesn't want it. Like I read the first one and she just like, she completely is in denial. She doesn't want to be a vampire. She's pissed because she, now that she's dead, other people are in her house and trying to sell her things. And all she wants are like her designer shoe collection.
It's weird to me that these, yeah, I've talked a lot in the last couple of years and people may get bored of it, but I'm so tired of genre as an idea that it sticks you into something. I've been on panels now with cozy writers that I really like, and everybody rolled their eyes when all the noir writers, when I said, I've read your books, and started talking to the ladies about the books they'd written, and I realized they hadn't read anything of mine to go on this panel, and I read theirs because I cared, and because I noticed they were doing something interesting, and genre was holding people back from reading other people's writing, instead of going, everybody who's writing, if it's good, who cares what genre it is? Because I really believe that fiction is at heart the lie we tell so we can get to the truth. And I think that's what we're all trying to do, no matter what genre is. We're trying to get to the truth, to our personal truth. And if you're telling the truth in a cozy, it's just as interesting to me as if you're telling it in the darkest noir, if you're telling your truth. If you're lying, I'm not that interested. And I can tell the difference pretty quickly. I think most readers can. You'll go, oh no, you didn't really feel that. You just thought that would be a good thing to sell a book. And I can feel in, it's like, I got somebody just recently, somebody came, drove all the way out from Salton Sea, which is a long way away, to a reading I was doing, and wanted me to sign the memoir. And he said what I've heard a lot, which is, he said, All the Wild Children is my story. And then he started to describe his youth, and you know what? They had nothing in common. And what I realized is, if you tell the truth, universality comes out of it. What he saw was his life, even though all the facts were different. And that can be cozy, that can be anything. If you're telling the truth, you'll hit universal truths, because truth is real. And making up what you think audiences want to read or what a genre demands of you doesn't get you anything good, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, it's not like we can relate to vampires, but, you know, there's going to be characters that you love. And
it's Charlie Houston stole this from somebody, and he and I argued back and forth about who he heard this from, so I just attributed it to him and then let him take the heat for it. Is he said, when we're writing crime fiction, it's just us with guns. And if, and if you're writing vampire, it's just us drinking blood. You know, that's the truth. We aren't, that's when somebody goes, how could you write a vampire? Well, how could I write anyone? It's just me with superposing who I am with something different in it.
Yeah. And I, you know, to credit to where it's due, I had to cheat and look it up because I can never remember this woman's name, but it's Mary Janice Davidson is the author of Undead and Unwed. And that's hilarious.
That's really cool.
I love when you can make things like being dead, like undead and unemployed is like her, one of her, the second one. And that's the thing. It's like this poor, you know, woman is, you know, she's an undead vampire now. And like, she just wants her job and she's, you know, like she's, it's ridiculous. And I'm like, oh my God, this is totally relatable. She's out of work. And like, it's fun.
I think we're living in kind of in the golden age of crossover into that, into both into horror and into fantasy. In way, it's Charlie, when he was writing his early books, had a contract like most of us do that said he couldn't put out crime fiction if he had a crime fiction out. And I don't know why the publishers think we can't read more than one book a year. It turns out we do, but there, you know, that's just a longstanding thing. So he wrote the Joe Pitt series, which is basically hard-boiled novels with a vampire. But it was this crossover that allowed him to write two books a year so he could, you know, get the stuff out there. Make a living. It was really what it was about, supporting his family. But I look at that and go, that's what we're living in, this golden age where you cross anything can cross over and people are pretty okay with it, except for publishing and agents get nervous about it. But readers and writers don't seem to have a problem with it.
Yeah, it's true, because in comics, people sort of, I think they do that to writers. I don't know that they do it to artists so much, but they seem to do that to writers. And and it seems to just be kind of a thing. I talked to a lot of people about, whether or not they use a pen name and, and why they do or they don't. But one of the reasons was it was sort of like you almost felt like you had to say you wanted to put out a children's series or a YA series that would conflict with the erotica you wrote last year or something. And it's like, why? It's still all, like you're saying, your readers will follow you, and if they're appropriate to.
And yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's I was talking to a cozy writer who's does a lot of good books, but she put out an erotic series, which was actually selling quite well. But her publisher and agent said you have to use a different name. And I sort of get it as a branding thing. Like I get the branding concept. I don't know that it's necessary. I think it dilutes the deepness of a writer when you don't know they do all these different things for me, but I look at it from a writer's perspective, so what do I know,
Yeah.
you know?
No, that's just it. I agree with you, and I think it's not, I don't really see the benefit these days in how we live in a time where we want to know every single detail about these people, whether we know them personally or not. And that's, like the celebrities, the writers, the directors, the
Yep.
actors, whoever they are, we feel like we want to know them. And I don't know how much you really get to know somebody if they have three different pen names.
It's
Because it's all going to be exposed anyway, like J.K. Rowling learned. I
yeah,
mean, it's
no,
all going to be, it's going to come out who's who.
it will come out, and it's always funny to me when people want to know more about a writer's personal life, and you go, well, read their books, you'll know everything you ever wanted to know. You just have to decode it. You know, if you want to know how
Yeah.
I feel about the world, read my books. It's much better than actually talking to me. You'll discover what I truly feel in
Yeah, my mother hates reading my work.
my books.
I've decided that I'm not giving her any more. She's like, it's too hard for me to read this. It's all you.
There's a thing about that that is true about mothers and fathers and parents at different levels, is it's very hard as a parent to divorce yourself from the fact that you feel responsible as that is one of your works of art as that child. And so you take personally what they do, not just personally because you love them, but personally because it reflects on you at some level. And I don't think there's any way around that, frankly. I mean, my father didn't I read my father my memoir before he died, and it's hard. It's a hard book. It's fucking hard. And at the end of it, because he's an artist, he said, I always wondered what it felt like to be you. And then we spent half a day talking about structural ideas and things I was doing with literature and what I was trying to do with the language in it. He's one of the few people who didn't get swept up in the story to the point where he couldn't talk about what I'm doing as a writer. But that's rare. He was an artist, and he's also was completely self-absorbed, so it didn't really bother him. I think he just listened for the parts where his name was mentioned, you know?
Yeah, I wanted to know how he came off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing with this new book. Some people talk about tropes, and I don't really know what this means. And it's one of the wonderful things about never going to college and just reading a lot is they'll say, oh, you hit all of the tropes of the heist novel. And I thought, I don't quite know what that means, but okay, good. And then they'll say, but what makes it different is your characters are so alive, so three-dimensional. And I thought, well, yeah, isn't that the point? Isn't that why we write anything, is to talk about alive people, you know?
Yeah, you hope so, because you can feel when a character is one-dimensional. And sometimes, maybe you're under the gun of some kind of stupid deadline or whatever it is that those characters end up coming out where they don't serve much purpose. They called it the manic pixie dream girl, which I kind of disagreed with, but
I call it
I understand what they were
thug number
saying.
one.
Yeah,
I
minion.
I was watching, I took my son on my birthday. My older boy wanted to go see the Bond movie for my birthday. And I said, great, let's go see the Bond movie. That sounds like a bonding thing. I like it. And I was watching it. And I kept thinking, I want to write a novel from the point of view of thug number 27 in a Bond novel. The guy we never talk about, he just gets killed. And there's all these guys running around. There's a villain and a hero. And then there's all these guys kind of running around. I want to go, what would it be like to be one of those guys and know? What would Star Wars be like if you told it from Stormtrooper 437? What would that
Yeah,
view of
there's
it be, you know?
it's like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern,
Yes,
right?
exactly.
And if you ever poke around YouTube, look up Chad Vader. because Chad Vader is
I
Darth
just spit
Vader.
coffee out of my nose. What a good name,
Sorry.
Chad Vader.
Chad Vader is like supposedly Darth Vader's brother who works in like a supermarket. It's like so fucking funny.
Love it. There is something to that, though. It's James Lee Burke has written in the last two books, he's written sections about war. In the one, not the one that's out right now, which is House of the Rising Sun, the one before that, he writes about a section where a character's in World War II, and he describes it in a chapter and a half. And I realize he takes you through a whole tank battle from one perspective, from a soldier trying to run around these tanks, crushing people and all these things. And it's such a small vision that it makes it real. And you feel all the stuff around it, but he doesn't try and tell you the whole story. And in the new book, there's a section of a guy in France in World War I. And just these giant, what mustard gas does is you're about to go out of the trenches and over the wall. And what it, these giant, huge plumes of dirt filling the, covering the sun as they blow up armaments around you. And it's this very small way of looking at war. That is, we're so used to the big screen epic. And what's really interesting and what really captures me and makes me see the bigger war is just the one man's perspective or one woman's perspective of that event. Like not trying to tell the big picture. He doesn't tell you what army's here and what's over there and left. What writers love to do is they call it world building, and sometimes it's just boredom building for me, is to tell you where everything is so you have the whole scene in your head. Well, I want to know what one guy going through it felt like who couldn't see all those things. All he could see is the little bit of road ahead of him, and he could see the ladder, and he could hear the whistle and go up over that hill and know he was going to be shot at. And that sort of dialing down of an idea down to one person's point of view is something I'm trying to really look at and think about for this new novel I'm working on right now, which is just trying to look at how do we tell a big story through a small perspective. I don't know if that makes any fucking sense, but it does to me, so I'm going by it.
Yeah, no, I think it's fine. I think it's a good way to break something down into something manageable.
Yeah, it's
Yeah, it's I mean that's kind of how I have to approach things that are t I feel are too daunting.
yeah.
I'm like, okay, well, what's the one thing that I mean, and seriously, to put it in like a real practical perspective, I'm like, okay, if I have to clean the house today, how can I break this down into something that I can handle? And what, you know, it's like, okay, I will do this part. I will dust for right now for the next, you know, half an hour.
It's
And it's, you know, breaking it down.
no, I it's I. And I've talked to you before about this. I've been sober for a lot of fucking years. I've been sober longer than most young writers have been alive. But my sponsor, who's been also a writer, he's been my sponsor forever. I wanted to make a movie years ago, and I did make the movie. And he said, "Okay, you want to make a movie? You haven't done it. Break it down into steps, and every morning do the last thing you ever want to do first, so you don't spend the whole day worrying about it. Do
Exactly.
that thing first that you hate the most, and then." And while working a day job, I put together a film and shot it and made it. And again, Tad Williams, my partner in crime, he and I wrote the screenplay. And we just, every day I did one little thing off the list. And it turned out 2 years later, I was buying a ticket to go see my own movie. And I went, pretty much anything can be done if you break it down that way. You can't write a novel, but you can maybe write a chapter. And if you can write a chapter, you can write the next chapter. And it's what stops us is imagining writing a whole novel. Well, it's not possible to write a whole novel. It's just not possible. But it is possible to write a chapter. And that's like anytime I get daunted by the how this next project is something really close to my heart, but very big. And I go, I can't do that. I go, well, I know how to write the first chapter. I think I know that much. And so that's all I'm doing, you know, chapter by chapter, getting to, and I'll get to the end.
There are so many writers and aspiring writers who never finish. Why do you think that happens when it's like, yeah, I do know this chapter and I know this scene and I want to get this out of my head, but they don't, because I know you're a pantser, you don't sit there and outline, so
Yes, I think pantser is a really weird term, by the way. I like it. I get what it means.
I
But
know.
I always thought of pantsing like when we were in kids in grammar school, pantsing was when they pulled your pants down in front of everyone. So that I'm not that, okay? I may pull my own pants down. I never pull anyone else's. So I want to make that clear from the get-go as a pantser.
Yes, it's a fly by the seat of your pants, is what we call it.
Yeah. No, and it turns out most of my favorite writers write that way. Tim Hallinan, who writes these amazingly complex, interesting novels, never knows where it's going to go when he starts.
So do you have a big giant slush pile of shit that's not finished?
No, and what I did when I was younger, I've started doing a couple things. I think we get hung up on story a lot as writers, and I don't think story matters shit to me. Never has. It's why I love Raymond Chandler. Story didn't matter to him either. I love character. But what I have to know is, are those characters, is that world enough to sustain me for the next year? And a year is a lot of hours typing. And what I did on this one, there was an anthology put together called Feeding Kate to raise money for a critic who was having some health problems. And Young Americans was a short story I wrote. And I wrote it for that really as a proof of concept to see if it would hold water. Would it keep me interested? Not would it hold water, because that sounds logical. No, were those characters people I wanted to spend the next year of my life with? I'm doing the same thing with this new novel, is that I'm taking the world that it's going to be in and writing a couple short stories to go, and as I've written them, I go, okay, this is a world I want to be in. I care about this world. There's something in it that it will keep me going for a year. Because what has happened when I was younger, and I know I did it with scripts and other things, I would start writing and wouldn't really know the world or whether I love the world. And you put in 20,000 words and go, ah, oh, this kind of sucks. I don't like that. I'm bored. I don't want to go back to this world. The world wasn't rich enough then. You didn't pick a world that was rich enough and held your heart, in my mind. The fact is, there's a few of us, very few of us will make a living doing this, which means we're doing this as a labor of love as writers. That's job one. We all have to know that. We do it as a labor of love. And to do a labor of love means you have to do something you're in love with. You have to look at, do I love this story enough? Not do I think it will sell, not do I think it's a cute idea, not will my mom think I'm cute or that agent think I'm good, but is this a story I'm personally invested in and in love with enough to go a year with? If I met this at tomorrow, I was out in a bar and I met this story, would I say, yeah, that's a one night story? Or would I say, that story I think I want to get hitched up to?
A one night story. That is
But
fantastic.
you know what I mean? I mean, I.
Yes, I know what you mean. And it's amazing to hear you say it because before I started this latest book, I've been going back and forth almost every day with our friend Eliza Drew,
Yeah.
who's
Love her.
love her to pieces and one of the contributors to the anthology we're all in for Protectors Volume 2. And I was getting to the point where after the first book was getting, yet another rejection, and I was just feeling down. I'm like, okay, well, my plan was to do, a sequel and to make this more, kind of like a series, at least to, I don't know how many books I'd get out of it, but I wanted more than one book with this character. And I said, but on the other hand, I could try to write some vampire story and maybe actually get an agent. And she's like, no. Just don't. She's like, you're not gonna want to do it. You're gonna struggle with it. It's, and struggling when you do love something is hard enough. Like I've struggled to get, I hate revising, hate it with a passion.
We're gonna talk
But
about that in a minute, but go on.
okay, so she's like, if you try to cross into a genre just because it's popular when it's not what you want to write, she's like, what? She's like, that's just nonsense. And I'm like, yeah.
There's again with dating, there's two things about that are really strong to me. One is, if you write something you love, at least one person in the universe is going to love it. If you don't write something you love, that's not guaranteed anyone will love it. So that's one. The second is, I used to say when people would go out dating, or my sons or anyone else asked me about dating, I would say, be yourself, because otherwise, you might meet the right person and they won't recognize you. And I think that's true about writing. Like, write what you love, because then other readers and writers who like what you like will recognize you. They'll go, oh, that's that flavor I like too. Where if you're faking it, they'll never notice it. If you're pretending you're someone you aren't going to find the true people who will love your voice. And your voice is about truth. I think. That's what a voice is. When we talk about writer's voice, we make it very complicated. Like, how do I find my voice? Well, just tell the truth, and that will be your voice.
Sure, and that's, whether it's painting or music or whatever, that's it, you might have to sit through all of the same schoolwork as everybody else. I'm sure there were similarities, even though I went to school in New Jersey. I'm sure we had some similarities in how we went through English class.
Well, we didn't probably because I went through dummies English.
Okay,
This is
well.
really weird. I was thinking about this the other day. I'm trying to write a new character about this. I went through, they were trying, sitting in my, I because I'm dyslexic, I did go to dummies English, which was, remedial English. At the same time, I'm reading Shakespeare. So it was really confusing. But I remember the teacher saying, trying to explain what a metaphor is to the class. And he says, the cop pulls the guy over and says, "Where's the fire, Mario Andretti?" And he said, "What is that?" And I wanted to raise my hand and say, "What that is, a mixed metaphor and a bad one at best." And I realized that would make the other kids feel stupid. And I thought, just shut the fuck up, Jeff. Just get through the damn class.
But we've both read Shakespeare. We've both read some Shakespeare.
Yeah, I love Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I think if you want to learn how that's the other thing. I think to write a novel, read Shakespeare, read all of Shakespeare, read Shakespeare until it doesn't sound weird to you and you get it, because that's the what they were doing at his time of writing was so clearly structurally what we're still doing today. It just, I think that's why structure is ingrained in me. I never structure plan out a structure, but I look at it backwards and go, oh yeah, it's a perfect structure. But Shakespeare was really good at sort of nailing the structural aspect of something. So I think that's why we have to read a lot. Revising, I'm switching gears quickly back to revising.
Yeah, get back to
Why
that.
do you hate revising?
Once I have something out of my head, I kind of don't want to look at it.
What's that about?
I don't know. I just feel done. Like, I know, first of all, I'm like, I know that you go through a lot of typing issues because of the dyslexia. I'm just a bad typist.
You can
So,
claim dyslexia. I'll invite you into my tribe.
yeah, all right, awesome. And so I know that it's going to be a lot of grunt work. And then as they say, like the first draft of your story is the draft for you, not the draft to be read by anybody else. So I sort of feel like, okay, I've told myself this story. What else can I do? It's one of those things where to me the revising part is really so hard.
It's something I do that I don't know whether other writers do. I've never asked them actually this, but when I sit down to write every day, I go through the chapter before it and I rewrite it. And I rewrite up into where I'm at until I know what happens next. So I'm rewriting the whole time I'm writing. I'm always refining it. And I love, love, love language. I love a good sentence. I adore a good paragraph. So that part I like, but once the story's out, what I love about it is the pressure's off. I can then just play with language and character because the pressure, when you're pantsing, as they say, when you're writing without an outline, there is a terrifying pressure through the whole thing for me. I'm afraid every time I sit down to type. What if nothing happens? What if I don't know what happened next? What if I'm 50,000 words into a story and this novel doesn't have an end because I got it wrong? That's never happened, but that's my fear every goddamn time. Once I have it out on page and have the whole thing written, I relax then and go, okay, now how can I just shape it and play with it? Now I have some free time. So that's part of it. The other thing for revising for me is I am so lucky I am married to the best editor I know. And nothing goes out that Erica doesn't go through and be really, we just hammer together the language until it's right. And that's a painful, fun process. It's painful because I hate being told didn't do it perfect the first time. It's painful as a guy because I'm kind of, I want to be the hero who always gets it right. And she's saying you got it wrong. So I have to go through all that male bullshit. But it's wonderful because by the end of it, I get to a better piece of writing. And that's all that matters to me. And then I have Elizabeth White, who I work with, who then, as another editor, goes in and she beats it up another way. And to me, that's fun in that we're getting it right. Like the hard part for me was getting the story out, and now we're just trying to refine it. We're trying to, in Young Americans, Elizabeth White noticed there was a character and a subplot. She said, "Why is that here?" And I realized, and she editors are good at pointing out the problem and not very good at solving it if they're good. They shouldn't solve it for you. They point it out, and you, as the writer, have to figure out how you're going to solve it. But she said the subplot it just seemed to slow things down. And I looked and I realized the reason why was the character wasn't a real character. It was just a kind of stand-in cutout for a type of character that the plot needed. And once I saw that, I could rewrite it. Well, that was actually exciting to me. It wasn't painful. It was like, oh, cool. I see that problem. I know how to fix that. It's almost like I get to be a cabinet maker on some of those things and not be so tortured.
Oh, okay. I sort of feel like something is a big failure though if it's like that.
No.
And I know, yeah, I mean, I know that's just like part of the process. Like the last comic script that I've been working on forever, everybody has heard me talk about it a million times. So the artist that I've been going back and forth with, I abandoned it like with the 2 pages to go in order to tackle this novel because it was National Novel Writing Month was coming up and he was going off to Greece for a month. So I'm like, all right, so this is a good time for me to forget about the comic for a while. But he pointed out where he felt like a couple of these characters were just flat because they were background characters. I'm like, well, it's not about them. I just need to know that they are there in the scene, that this is expressing that this is a family. So these are all the people that are part of the family, but the character that we care about is this guy over here. And so I was afraid then because comics is kind of having this renaissance right now with trying to not make things about white male characters. He's like, can we do something different here? And he's like, this character, this sister, she bothers me. Well, I don't know. And I said, okay, well, how about this? How about if I change the whole point of view, and that it's no longer a story about this dude sitting in jail, which can sound like a boring story. So it's not going to be just 22 pages of him sitting in jail, and we're going to talk about what his wife and her sister are doing. He's like, that's a better story.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's you said something before this which is so key because I get it 100%. I will laugh at it and I get it. Is it feels like you did it wrong. And like we're so afraid of doing it wrong if we have to rewrite it or if somebody calls us out on it. That's a killer to good art. Like you didn't do it wrong. You're in a discovery process. I hope there's a lot that we each write that we go, fuck, that led me to a better idea. It didn't mean I did it wrong. It means I'm on the path to a process. That if everything I wrote was perfect when I first shat it out, boy, that'd be interesting, but I wouldn't have as much fun. I wouldn't have a year to work on something. I'd be done in about 6 weeks and I'd move on. I like being in this world. I like that discovery. And it's taken me a long time to put the ego aside and say, you didn't get it wrong. You're in a process. You discovered something cool. Tad says about, and he said it early on about characters, and he said every one of those characters in his, he writes, like in Dragonbone Chair, which is big epic novels, every character thinks it's their novel. And he said, because he writes over 6 or 7 years, one of these giant sets of books, he said, I put in a bunch of spear carriers that may or may not be needed down the road. Because I want to have them alive in the novel if I need them. And he said, and one guy thinks I'm almost the star of the novel. I'm moving up. Other people are dying. I'm moving up. And that guy gets an arrow in the chest and goes, "You shot me? You fucking shot me?" Because that character thought it was about them. And I think that's that thing about like nobody is in there just to be a placeholder. Every character from their perspective, it's the novel is about them.
That was something that J.K. Rowling was brilliant about because there are times when I felt like her world building was too much for me to just enjoy as a reader
Yeah.
because I'm not used to reading fantasy novels. Other people are. But the way that a character would be mentioned in a paragraph somewhere would come back, 7 books later or something. And so the new movie that's coming out in for 2016 is the Fantastical Beasts and Where to Find Them, and it's about the guy who wrote a book. The book is what's mentioned in the Harry Potter things, and you get to know a little bit, like, oh, this is his name and he had a wife and he had a son, but it's like she took the author of a book that she mentioned and she then made a whole story about that guy.
I don't know how other people work, but knowing Tad has helped me with that. I thought they carried all that information with them through the whole series. And what Tad was saying is, no, he puts a certain amount of characters in there because he knows he may need them down the road. So he puts kind of interesting, weird characters he may never come back to, but then he's got them. Because over the course of writing for 6 years on a giant group of books, you change who you are. You change what you want to be writing about. If you don't, you're not living. So if you're changing, then you may need that character who wrote that book back then. So you put enough of that richness in the world so you can pull back to it. And people will go, oh, he knew he was going to get back to the character. And he's going, no, actually, I just put a bunch of characters. I didn't know which ones I was going to need.
I think that's much easier to see maybe in music when we see like somebody's happy in love album and then you get their breakup album. It's like, oh yeah. Like Adele goes through that. Adele's a common one. Alanis Morissette. She probably never wants to sing Jagged Little Pill again.
Sorry. Sorry, dear. It's, I don't, I think it's where we as writers allow brand to trap us. And I don't, I may piss people off for the rest of my life because I can't write the same book every year. I'm not the same person. And if I'm not growing intellectually and spiritually and in my heart and the way I view the world, then why be on this planet? And if I am doing those things and I'm being honest about what I'm writing, the books are going to be different every year. They won't fit into a happy little formula of 50 books in a row that are about the same thing, which doesn't mean you can't write within a series. James Lee Burke has written a series that has gone from when he was a young, middle-aged man until he's now writing about what it's like to be an old man. And the books grow with him. But they aren't the same book. You can't read the first book and the last book and think they're the same book. You know, he's letting it grow with him.
I think maybe, I don't know if it's so much with books as a reader, because, like the Harry Potter books, for example, you see them all growing up and going through ages. But when I think about movies and I think about action movies, I think there's something kind of stuck with us as viewers where we don't want those characters to age ever, and that's why shit keeps getting rebooted. Like Die Hard, like we've now seen, like old John McClane.
It's old. I worked at doing the trailers on the first one with old John McClane and his son in Russia, whatever the fuck that was. And to be honest, that's what bores me about Hollywood. I am so bored of seeing a reboot of the same idea. I was asking this morning, and I not to get into an in a heated discussion, because I think people will be. I don't mean this full-heartedly, but I do wonder if J.J. Abrams wonders if he ever gets to do something that was his. Because what he's really good is rebooting other people's ideas. And I wonder what interests me the most are not those things that are somebody rebooted, but somebody who actually comes up with something fresh. And the problem with fresh is if you do two of them in a row, I'm kind of bored because I know what you're doing. The first Die Hard blew my mind. It was so good. And from then on, I kind of go, I know how you're going to do this. I know how it works. I'm kind of bored. It's why I don't watch sports, because I kind of know what's going to happen. One team will win or the other. There's no real surprise. It isn't like if in sports, every once in a while, a quarterback ran down the field, dropped the ball, grabbed a tight end and kissed him on the lips and proposed marriage. I go, fuck, I'd watch that because it's interesting. I don't know what's going to happen. You know what I mean? But what's going to happen is one guy's going to run one way, one guy's going to, somebody's going to get knocked down, and one of the two teams will win. There is no third option. So if that's what movies become or stories become, once I know what they're doing, I'm kind of bored. I'm like, okay.
So talking about the characters aging and getting bored if they keep, Hollywood studios keep trying to wedge them into their younger roles. Like, I mean, we've had a, like 13 or something. I feel like Stallone movies now. But at least, I don't know. I'm really not that much of a Rocky fan. So it's like, okay, whatever. I saw him. I saw, I think, like one, two, and four, maybe, or something. I don't know. But but thinking about that these actors have to go through this and they're kind of wedged. How do you feel as a writer? Do you feel old?
In some ways, I am dealing with, and I'm trying to deal with it in the writing in different ways and looking at it. I'm having a very strange career in that I am, because I have white in my beard, I am being aged out of motion picture advertising. I am being treated, I was a big, lot of award-winning kind of rock star editor. They actually bought me, one company wanted to hire me, and I said, well, I'll work for you if you buy me a Harley, the prettiest custom Harley. And it was actually parked in front of their shop when I came into work for them. So I was that kind of an idiot, you know, young gun. My first trailer, big trailer, was RoboCop, and that kind of blew me up. And now I'm treated like a junior editor who's not too smart. And people ask me, I have 25-year-old producers ask me to do things that I fucking invented. And they try to explain to me how it works. And I want to go, you know, before I started cutting, that didn't exist. And I can't say that. So I go, yeah, let me explain. So I'm going through on one part. In Hollywood, the white in my beard has made me treated like I'm kind of the stupid stepchild who's there, hung around too long and embarrassed them. And in literature, I'm treated more and more with respect. And in writing, nobody gives a fuck what age you are if you're doing good work. And we as writers do our best work the more books we have under our belt, because we get better at it if we're any good at our craft. Each book is better than the one before it. So it's these two dichotomies. I feel quite old every day that I'm in Hollywood, and I feel young and excited and vibrant when I'm writing a novel. So I can write a novel about being a kid, like Young Americans is just this youth-driven novel, because that's the energy of that novel. I felt like a kid while writing it. You know, it brought me back to being that. It's exciting. It has the energy and the pace of a kid could have written that book. Most kids don't have that skill level, but it's written from that perspective, and I think it carries that. And yet, in the new novel I'm working on, it has a grandfather, and I'm trying to deal with both of those issues. So anyway, do I feel old? Yeah, some days. Some days I feel like a damn kid, man.
Well, it's funny that you come talking about the movies and literature together, because the pack of people that you have in Young Americans, and shout out for doing a great transgender character, by the way. She's fucking awesome.
Can we say
So
written 2 years ago, before all the shit blew up in the news?
yes, absolutely. Like
Yeah.
before people knew who Laverne Cox was, and she's awesome, and it's like a John Hughes film about stealing.
That's a great way of saying it. And yes, that's a great compliment. That's what I was hoping for. Whatever I fell in love with when I saw Breakfast Club is what I would love to see, which is these families of kids, you know, that kind of fun.
I mean, it's just this gaggle of teen 20 somethings, and they're fierce, and I love that the boys are hesitant and the boys are scared because they were the brains, and it's the girls who are the masterminds and the muscle. So it's amazing.
There's a thing that I'm doing in there, and I it's part of it is intentional, is wanting to. I don't believe in politics in writing. I really don't. But I want to make sure that I'm always stretching how I view gender. I want to make sure that I'm reflecting different, so that gender doesn't become locked into something, you know. And the freedom of not writing about the sex trade meant I had the freedom to write about women a different way, because that whole trade has its own thing in it, and Moses had his own view of it. And it was about a Neanderthal growing up. I mean, those were the, from the perspective of those novels, were a Neanderthal's view of women as he slowly evolves into a slightly less Neanderthalic man by three books in. And this allowed me to go, okay, let's not write about those. Let's write about this other way that women can be. And Valentina is my favorite character I've written.
I can't express how much I fucking love her.
And as you read it, she gets better, by the way. She'll blow your
I mean,
mind by
because
the
Candy is the one. I mean, first of all, I thought, okay, well, Sam, we get to know Sam right away, and I was thinking, oh wow, Sam is really relatable to me. And then Candy was this, one that had way more spunk, and I have some people who they only see me when I'm up, so
Yeah.
I think they probably think I'm that. But then, like, Valentina comes along, and I'm like, oh my God, she's fucking amazing.
Yeah, she's I
But yeah,
am.
Sam is probably the most relatable to me.
Do you know Sam wouldn't exist without you?
Aww.
That's true. No, it's true. You, when we were talking, when I was getting ready to write this book, you and I were talking back and forth, and one of the things you were talking a lot about was body image and the way that superheroes have to be the certain svelte look and all, and you're an absolutely beautiful woman and curvy and all those things. And I started thinking about a different way of imagining a female lead. And that's where Sam came out of, well, two things. One was that, and the other was because my elder sister prides herself on her skinniness, and I didn't want her to think the book was about her, although it has things like her. I didn't, because then we get into a whole, she starts worrying, did I present her correctly? Instead, it was like, no, I know you won't identify with this, so you'll be okay with me writing about it. But the real thing was knowing you. I just wanted to write somebody who I got what you were saying and thought, that's valid, that's interesting. I want to write
Yes.
about a woman who I write early on about her, that she made you rethink what glitter rock could be, because she wasn't skinny like David Bowie. She wasn't Twiggy. She wasn't, Margot Hemingway. She wasn't any of those people.
And it was interesting the way that the body came up, because first of all, it's that she's a stripper, so her job is to be objectified. And the way that she would, like, once in a while play things off, like how Candy was this classically beautiful character that all the boys, went crazy for, and but Sam had to use her sensuality,
Yeah.
that, in order to actually come off way stronger than Candy.
It's Candy's interesting, and I really wanted to get this right about, because a thing about it, of being coming of age for me, is sexuality. Teenage coming of age is a lot about our sexuality, discovering it. And Candy's thing, when Jacob's in love with her and can't understand why she's with all these different men. And Sam says, you've either got to be able to live with it or walk away, because that's who she is. If you're going to love her, you got to love who she is. And he says at one point, what do you want for Christmas? He says, I just want candy. And she says, you can't have her. She's not a thing you can have. She's a person. And to know that even that the cute candy who all the boys love and who fucks around a lot and has a lot of different boyfriends, that's her sexuality. And that has to be okay too. Like you have
Yeah.
to, that has to, that's an okay
And
way to, like, there's not a wrong way to be in this
that's
novel.
what all three of those, all three of the women that are leading this, this pack of thieves, all three of them own that completely, and I
Ah.
maybe that's because of that was the era.
No, it
I
was
know
like,
we talk about the 70s a lot, but
yeah, it is, it's the era, but it's also the intentionality of trying to, I mean, it really is. In many ways, a woman's novel. It's written from that
oh,
perspective.
vastly. And that was like when Sam actually trusts a guy and then he just fucks up. And it's like she kicks herself. She kicks herself harder than any mobster that's going to come after her.
Yes. I love that about her, though. It is. I grew up with two sisters, so, and I grew up, I've had best friends have been women my whole life. That's just, so I've known a lot of women, and that thing of women who, if somebody says, you aren't good enough for me, or I don't like you, or I rip you off, the women I've loved and known have all said, what did I do wrong? I fucked this up. And I wanted to look at that too and go, what is that about? Like, what the fuck? They did the shitty thing. Why do you feel shitty about it?
Yeah, and that's exactly the way a lot of us are.
Oh my God. I was doing the audiobook for this, which is amazing.
Oh, so you got to record?
Yeah, I worked with a woman and producer who did it, and they sent me chapters, and I got to audition people.
Oh, wicked. Okay.
And M. Eldridge, who did it, is this amazing voice. She's done, I don't know, 60 books or something, but she's young. And I wanted somebody young. And I auditioned men and women. And I came up with this really weird thing. Because the book is split between the brother and the sister's perspective. I thought, well, I'm not sure which will work. Every time men read women, their women's voice was kind of whiny. And I would say, and this, I'm talking about six different narrators. I would say, could you read it again? Just send me a new audition. Sam is not whiny. Give her some balls. It'd come back and she was whiny again. And I went, all these men, the only voice they know how to give a woman is kind of whiny. And then I had women start reading it. Women could read the men, no problem. And I thought, there's a cultural phenomenon at play here. Like, M happened to nail everyone. I love her read. You can, there's, it's on Audible, and there's a sample of it up on Amazon, and you can hear her voice. I think she's amazing. She really got it. But what she got was Sam's balls. And I went, if you don't have that, we don't have a, this novel doesn't work. if she's whiny, this novel doesn't work. And culturally, I don't know why men don't know that women don't have to be that. Sorry, guys, they don't.
Well, it's so funny that, you know, that you talk about like Sam having, you know, chutzpah and the balls. That's the
term. I mean,
that's the colloquialism we say.
She has solid steel ovaries is one I tend to use a lot.
Yeah, because like Betty White, she said, why do we say that somebody's a pussy if it means that they're weak? She's like, a pussy can take a pounding. And I'm like, oh, Betty White, I want to be you when I grow up.
I am a work in progress, okay? I am a fucking work in progress. There's a young woman from the Unitarian Church in my high school group, and she has just been nailing me over the years. And every time I say pussy or one of those, she goes, Josh, you know there's better words than that? Because what you're saying is being a woman is weak or wimpy, and that's not true, and I know you don't believe it, so change your language. I'm trying, man.
It depends. But if there's the thing, if your character is saying it, then it's talking about the character, not about you. And I think that was like a lot of people face that criticism when it comes to things like racist language or transphobic language. Like you have this cop that comes in and kind of gives Valentina some shit. And, it, you know, it's like you're making the character the asshole, not you.
Yeah, no, and if you're afraid to write anything, if you're afraid to write any word, if you're afraid, if you're worrying about somebody looking over your shoulder when you're writing what they'll think of you, it will always be shit that you write. So I don't write in a room with anybody looking over my shoulder. I write from what's in my head and hope to fuck it's good and hope that I'm evolving as a human enough that it comes into my subconscious that when I write, it shows up. But I don't think about that when writing. I think about that when living my life. I sit and talk to me like I talk to you and hear what you're saying about body image. And I hear what you say about this. Or I hear what this young woman said to me about using the word pussy and hope to God that filters into my writing. But I can't logically sit down and go, oh, this might be offensive to somebody. I don't know if I should say that because then I'm just going to write crap, you know?
Right.
You can't ever write good. I can't. I shouldn't say you. Other people write great, so I don't know how the fuck they do it. Me. If I sit down to write anything and I think, A, when I was younger, if I write this right, will it get me laid? Well, mm-hmm. That's going to turn out as crap. If I write this right, will people think I'm a nice guy? That always will turn out as crap. If I write this just correctly, will my mother, will anybody else like me? Will an agent like it? All that turns out crap for me. It just shit comes out of me at that point. No good writing. Good writing comes out when I don't imagine anyone's in the room with me. When it's just me trying to tell the fucking story. And,
well, that might be because you're not an asshole.
Well, yeah, but I'm a work in progress, as I've said. I'm a bit of an asshole. I say shitty things. I don't say things correctly. But we are all works in progress, right? Sure. We're all trying to get somewhere. And if we recognize that, then maybe we're doing a little better than average, you know? I guess that's for me is it's – I don't know whether I am or I'm not an asshole, but I know I'm trying to get better every year, and I hope that shows up in the writing. You know, but I also don't ever plan to put it in the writing. Pick on me about maybe, my daily speech. Just don't pick on me about my writing.
Yeah. Well, maybe in 30 years, then we'll have a part two memoir and it'll be, you know, a much different Josh Stallings.
I hope so. I hope that there's a different me. I also think it's weird. I've had this discussion with people about language and people get all hung up on, is that PC? You're being too PC. And you can't be too, because there's part of PC that matters to me is it's called correct. Politically correct. It upsets people. People, you're being politically correct. Well, there's part of that. It's two words. One is correct. And yes, I want to be correct, to be honest. I don't want people using the word retarded to mean all the shit that they think it means. I don't want to find myself using, when I was in high school, I was called woman because I was into glitter rock and the jocks would go, woman. And I would think, that's your best insult? Really? I like women. So really? That's your bet. But that languaging said to every woman in the quad who heard it, you aren't as good. We don't think you're as good as us. You're less than. And so language matters deeply because we got a whole generation of young girls coming up that we want to say something to, that we don't want them to grow up thinking they're less than, you know? That was a ramble.
But that's an awesome ramble. But before you go, do you have to go?
No, I'm here.
Okay. I was gonna say, 'cause I mean, I know what we were talking about, like the time period of the 70s and everything. Do you think that you could tell this story in a modern setting? Because I think about things like technology, and having technology like fail on my characters was one of the hardest thing for me to get through.
Oh, yeah.
Was trying to figure out like, okay, well, there's usually cameras everywhere and there's cell phones everywhere, and you know, it just like it feels a little bit cheap, but sometimes you have to be like, oh, but she left her charger at home or something. I don't know.
It's
But
it is
you know.
really hard. It's I think some of us have to embrace it. The Moses books, because they're written traditionally as kind of traditional stuff, as traditional hard boiled in a certain way, which is a guy going around trying to solve a problem driving around instead of getting on the internet and just Googling it. And to do that, I had to create a character who was, again, a Neanderthal who hated technology.
Yeah.
Felt technology was created to make him feel stupid. And he says that. Like his young partner's always going, why don't you just Google that? And he said, and he lets you know computers just make him feel stupid and he doesn't want to use them. Well, that was a conceit I had to use so I could write the novels. This, I loved being in the 70s because I kind of love not having all that technology. Tim Hallinan just wrote one of his books in the Hoke Rafferty series, which is about a travel writer in Bangkok. And it's all about some photos that wind up on a cell phone that a kid loses his cell phone, and his father's going to hate him because it's a new iPhone and it's expensive. So he goes and buys one from one of these corner vendors, and it winds up having these pictures on it that now everyone's trying to kill them to try and get away from these kids. And I thought he's actually thinking about technology as how do I play with it? Like, what are the things that it could do? As opposed to fighting
Right.
it the way I fight it so hard, he's actually going, well, how would this work? Okay, what would that be to a story?
Well, there's it's interesting because when we talk about a heist, I tend to forget that it's not always high tech to accomplish the goal, because it was just I'm gonna have to look this up to find the link and include it in the show notes, but it was a bunch of men in their like late 60s and 70s who had been career criminals, got back together to try and break in to something, and it was a matter they spent like 3 years planning it. And they would like the one guy would like sit in the bar across the street to do everything he could to calculate, you know, like record when activity was going on. And it was this most amazing, incredible story. But it was things as small as like cutting wires. Like, okay, well, you know, you need to be at least some sort of competency with electronics, which I'm not, to know where the alarm system is to cut the wires. And then guys who know how to use power tools to, you know, break in through these big cement walls. And they got caught. But to me it was still just like this brilliant idea that these old cahoots came together, you know, these coots got, and they, you know, they were just like, they're like, hey, we still got some life and juice in us. Let's go break into the Bank of England or whatever the fuck it was. I'm like, this is awesome.
That's writing a heist novel has, like, you've got to make a bunch of shit up that I don't normally think about. Like, how do you do it? What would you do? How are those, te how, what does technology, what would you need to do it? And time and place matter so much to me that it informs so much of my heist. There was a big thing that people of the time, people of my generation, will get certain jokes in it that other people won't. Like, there was a the Pinto was a car that was pretty much destroyed by a myth, and the myth was that they blew up when they were rear-ended. Turns out they weren't any more apt to blow up than anything else, but that was the myth at the time. So I have my kids blow up a Pinto in the story. And it's those kind of things that are like time and place gave me that. I think time matters so much when I write, like what era it's in. The thing that I wrote in Collectors, I mean in Heroes, that the anthology we were both in, is about Daryl Gates and Nancy Reagan and a crack house raid. But it's about a period, and the period I like periods. They give me something else to play with. It's like there's a lot that they inform for me. So I think I'm always going to like to play with that, with period at some level. And young Americans you asked me earlier whether could it happen now, and I don't think so. I don't. We're different. We're at a different place sexually. It's like right now, my nieces and nephews, if they find out someone's gay, they're like, so what do I care? I wasn't going to date them, so I don't really care if they're gay or straight. The 70s, it was more outlaw to have that a point of view. So there's more stuff that's just culturally in time and place for me. I time and place matter every, and I don't know what, they matter so much to me when I'm writing, like knowing the time and place and getting it. I'm working on this big LA novel, and I want to write my love letter to LA. And it's about time and place. It's about the place. The Moses books, people who live in Northeast LA and East LA where I live, love them because they know all the places in them. Even if I've changed all the names, which I do, just so that someone doesn't go, those seats are supposed to be orange and you said they're yellow. I don't give a shit. So I changed the name.
Well, I wasn't sure because you call the club, you refer to one of the clubs, didn't you, as the city?
I did that's in an interview. The one that
the interview. Okay, yeah, but that's, you call it Taxi Dancer.
Taxi Dancer, okay. Which was the city. It's based on that. But again, if I wrote about the city, then someone would get. I hate it when you get facts wrong. Like I'm reading a book and it's about something I know, and you get it wrong, I go, what? And it takes me out. So the way I get around that is I fictionalize everything. I did one thing that has gotten me in trouble is there's a coffee shop in it called Lions. which I intentionally spelled like the cat Lions, and the coffee shop when we were growing up had a Y in it, and is L-Y. And two people have already contacted me, one of them, Tad, saying, you know, you misspelled Lions. And I'm trying to go, I should have called it Tigers. It would have been a better joke. There's a lot of these kind of weird inside jokes in this that if you grew up with me and with my friends, you'll go, I know what you're talking about there. But that was one where they just thought I spelled it wrong. And really what I'm trying to do is fictionalize it so that I have freedom to put the damn booth any place I want them, you know?
Yeah. I like to fictionalize locations to like kind of base them on other things and then, you know, make them just, I don't know that anybody who read them would have any, you know, catch the resemblance of anything other than, okay, well, this is a small town here and this is a, you know, a hotel here. I mean, it's just, you know, I think they're pretty generic. But I'm thinking about the technology and stuff, and some people are like really great at inventing, or at least taking a concept of something that's a theory and then inventing the technology that would solve the problem. And I don't know if you would ever consider doing that. Like thinking about stealing diamonds and stuff, because diamonds have serial numbers now, laser engraved. And you don't notice it when you buy the diamond. Like a good jeweler will show it to you so that you've seen it. And I'm like, Jesus, can you even steal diamonds anymore? Because you can't fence them.
Well, unless they're big enough that you can recut them.
If you can, yeah.
They lose value the minute you do that. So.
Right. So that's the thing. Like there's, you know, like an episode of Leverage where they say that there's a laser that can take the mark out. And I'm like, oh, well, that's probably an invented thing because I could be wrong. I don't know. But
it's funny, though, that upsets people as much as anything else. They'll go, well, that doesn't exist. You're going, it's a fiction. Of course it doesn't exist. They made it up. I make a lot of shit up. I make all kinds of shit up. I think that's our job. I don't feel like it's my job to teach you how to do crime in a way that will actually teach you how to do crime. It's my job to make up shit that's interesting for characters to do so you can see these characters doing different things. You know? I don't know that I could write like science fiction. I don't know that I could ever write. I don't know that my brain works that way. I realized everything that I write has some sense of me needing to dig into something real and then see how I feel about it. And you know, it's like I for the new book, which is about LAPD and about how we treat mentally ill people and about a bunch of things. But I went down and met with the LAPD, a guy who runs the division. And I talked to these people, and that starts my brain going. I don't know that I have the brain to sit down and go. And 30 years in the future, I'm gonna invent shit. It isn't my area of research. It isn't the area that interests me. The guys I know who are good at it, that's what they read about all day long. They love reading about science and where it's going and what's being invented and where are we going to be. It just isn't what, it doesn't trip my trigger. I don't know why, but it's, so I don't think I'll be writing those, okay?
Okay, that's all. I was wondering,
Big
and but I have
techno
one more
thriller not
thing.
coming.
All right, awesome. So when I was trying to look up Young Americans on Amazon, I found a couple different hits, and then I thought, okay, well, this is weird. Why do these look this way? So I went over to your website and clicked the link from your website, and I'm like, oh, okay. So through your website, if you click that link, the book is $13. And yet, there's like sellers out there that are selling your book for as much as $44. I was wondering how you felt about that.
I think it sucks ass, by the way. It does.
Awesome.
And the reason it sucks ass,
Because they're making the money that you're not.
well, and more importantly, I actually lowered my profit this last year by lowering my book cost. And because, and it's only a dollar a cop of all my books, but across the books, I had them do that because it's hard times for readers, you know? And I made a point, if anybody ever wants one of my books and they contact me, I send one to them. You know, just because we are living in economically hard times and books fucking matter. And when somebody takes a piece of art and makes it more expensive than people can afford, I say, fuck you. Adele has a concert in LA, sells out in 45 minutes, and now her tickets, which were 120 bucks, are 1,000 bucks. Well, fuck you. The one percenters shouldn't be the only people who get to go see Adele. And the people who can afford $45 for my book aren't the only people who should be able to read my books. They should be in libraries. I had this thing lately where a bunch of my books showed up. No, Young American, not a bunch of them. Young American showed up being on a pirated site where you paid for a subscription and then you could download it for free. And it outraged me. And somebody said, well, why? Why are you so outraged about it? And I thought about it kind of in depth and had this conversation. What I got to was, if you get it from a library for free, I don't get paid. I don't care. I'm happy. I just don't want some other son of a bitch getting the money. Who all they did was put up a website and steal my stuff. And I'm a little concerned that we have a culture that believes content should be free.
There
Because.
was it was on Thomas Pluck, our other dear friend. He had a post up recently where somebody, and the guy, I mean, it did make me pause and think. One of his commenters said, "Well, what's the difference between pirating and a library?" And it was like, "Well, the library is there based because it exists from tax dollars. It is provides many services, not only the books, but libraries provide services and they provide the cultural environment instead of some server." And like you said, a lot of creators out there will just willingly say, look, if you can't have something, I will give it to you. That's why they have things like I have the Patreon going. A lot of other friends of mine have Patreons going, and or they'll have that in comics. There's sort of a, I can't remember what they call it now, but it's like a tip jar system, like a pay whatever you want thing. They're like, you name your own price. So
That's
some
awesome.
people are, so some people will pay $5 or $6 for, and other people can pay one or nothing. If they choose nothing, it still goes through.
I kind of love that a lot. It's there's a teacher who I've done Skypes with in St. Paul, teaches a kind of rough inner city school, and his kids, a lot of the Moses books were the first books they've read that were fiction, and they fell in love with me as a writer. I heard from him, he said, as soon as I can get enough money, I'm going to buy Young Americans. I can't wait. And I immediately got in touch with him and said, I'm sending you three copies. See who else needs it. Let me know. Because I'm starting to think I'm going to put together a website that's about teachers and librarians and authors giving back. Because if it weren't for librarians, I wouldn't be educated. I wouldn't know what good writing is. I wouldn't have had somebody say to me, you're a really smart kid, although you don't test that way. Why don't you read James and the Giant Peach? That happened because libraries existed, because teachers cared. And that matters deeply to me. I know too many of us who grew up poor, who libraries where we learned to read and where we learned good literature, and there were people in there who cared about us and showed us what books would work. So libraries, I love. I don't give a shit if they make money for me. Who cares? They're getting readers, books in readers' hands. That's gorgeous.
I get to the point where, first of all, I want to be artists to be able to make money and make a livable wage. But when it's something like a library or or going and giving out whatever free copies you want, to me that's the difference there is choice.
Absolutely.
It was the creator's choice to give it away versus some total stranger sticking it up on a server.
It's the tip jar idea for it to work, and I think it's great, is we need to see if we what I want to say to young people, and I hate to say this about young people, but it's more prevalent in 20 somethings than in 50 somethings, is look what happened to news when we stopped paying for content. There are very few good reporters out in there anymore. Because what we did was we democratized news, but what that meant is everybody's basically putting up their own opinion, not telling us news. There aren't very, and that's because we stopped paying for content, because we demand our news free. Well, in 10 years, if no writers, I just read a thing in The Guardian that said novel writing has become the purview of the wealthy and the retired. And that broke my heart.
And
It's
that's
like,
true. Yeah.
if we aren't going to pay for content, sorry, kids, you're 10 years away from not having any good writers out there because they can't afford to do it. And that's fucking sad. And I don't know a single writer who isn't having a hard time right now. And I mean, big writers are having a hard time. It's a hard time to try to make a living because everybody wants it for free. At some point, you've got to go, you're responsible with your dollar. How are you? Somebody said this, oh, another thing on one of my sites when I was talking about piracy, and he said, they think it's so punk to steal a book, and yet they will give $600 to Apple for a phone. They
Right.
aren't sticking it to the man, they're sticking it to the artist. And we
Right.
need to get that ethic out there. We need to start talking about it publicly and saying, really? Really? You'll give Apple all your money and you say, fuck the writer? Really? Or Torrent. You're gonna be, people do this all and drive me crazy because I work in the movie business, is they steal movies. And they say, well, it's not hurting anybody, it's just hurting big corporations. No. The writer on that movie has a piece of the action. Everybody has a piece. That's how they're making their fucking living. And there's creative people all down the line who depend on that movie making money so they can afford to do another one next year. And if you like the movie, don't you want them to do another one next year? Don't you want them to be able to have a family and a home and all those things so they can afford to make another movie? Because if you think you should get it for free, that won't exist anymore.
That was definitely something that I saw in webcamming, was people come into the room right away because they want to see if it's for free. And you can see, you as the performer, can see if they have anything in their bank. And if they have no, if they have nothing to tip you, then you have literally zero incentive.
I've noticed that in a lot of the sex trade on the internet is there is so much free stuff out there. I'm wondering when internet was originally driven by porn and driven by sex for sale. Porn sounds pejorative, and I don't mean that. I mean, it's just sex for sale. I think that's better for me is sex is commerce. But now there's so much free stuff. I'm going, how's anybody making money off this anymore?
It's hard. A lot of them are doing it through public appearances. They're still dancing for the women anyway. They do things like Playboy, which now is like basically defunct. Playboy is now a pop culture magazine,
Not
and
weird.
yeah, it's totally weird. So they have to get it all in these other ways, and I think that's what I think it is the same as writing. Like I know a lot of writers who have to be teachers, or you have a day job that you don't hate,
Some
and
days.
that's yeah. I mean, well, I don't think you would have done it since you were 21 if
No,
you
there's
hated
so
it.
much I love about it. But no, yeah, I agree. It's but what it means is you're getting novels out of me, but it's only because a lot of people don't. My wife says, Josh, you can't compare other people to you. And I have take it's hard for me to get to that point, but the truth is, I tend to work. Most days I sleep 4 hours, and that's the only way I can do it is I work two jobs. Well, not everyone can do that. It doesn't mean they aren't a great writer. They may just not have that physical stamina. They may not have that Viking gene that says, keep fucking going. That doesn't make any better or worse than them. They may write a better book, but we'll never read it because they had to spend their day doing a job that burned them out. That's sad to me. That's like, it's anytime we lose a voice because they couldn't afford to write, makes me sad. Because I need lots of voices, man. I need to hear everybody's voice. Come on, people.
Yeah, otherwise it's just going to be more rich white guys producing content.
Yeah, and it's, they bore me. They bore me to tears.
So,
Complete
I mean.
socialist now, so that's a whole other story.
Oh, awesome. All right, Josh, before I let you go, let's inform the kind listeners where they can find you and get to know you and stuff, and maybe I don't know if you're doing any kind of touring for the new year.
I am not what I'm doing. I'm the God, I'm mumbling. I am going to be in Austin at Book People on February 1st with Terry Shames. And if you haven't read Terry Shames, shame on you. She's fucking awesome. She writes about a small town retired chief of police in a small Texas town, and she's just awesome. So anyway, she and I are reading at Book People on February 1st. And other than that, I'm just waiting to see what comes up next. You can always find me at joshstallings.com. And that has links to me socially. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. I'm on Amazon. Your local bookstore can order me. Most of them, I'm only carried by about 3 bookstores in the country right now. I'm trying to widen that out because I sell really well wherever I am, but it's hard to get into bookstores. But your bookstore can't order them. They are through Ingram, so like any bookstore can get them. And what the fuck else?
I don't know. Are you doing like BoucherCon or?
Yes, I am going to be at Left Coast Crime and then at BoucherCon. Left Coast Crime is in Phoenix this year, end of February. And that looks to be some big fun. It's nice. It's a littler conference, so I like it. And BoucherCon is where this year?
I don't remember. It might be, is that the one in California?
No,
Or is
that was
it
last year. We were in California.
last year?
Oh, New Orleans. New
Oh,
Orleans.
okay.
I'm already signed up for that. That'll be fun. Although I wish I could afford to spend time there before or after. And you go to these conferences, I really can't take the time off. So I will be at New Orleans, but I'll really just be in a convention center. So.
So you're not going to get to enjoy the environment of New Orleans,
No.
the
No.
life that's down there,
I find.
the life and the death, because New Orleans is one of those cities all about, horror, and they honor their dead there.
My son had a horrible experience there. He was living as a traveler, he and his girlfriend. And because they're a biracial couple, she's black and he's white, they just were treated like shit. And he said he couldn't, there was something after Katrina and all that's going on that New Orleans felt so oppressively dark and painful
Oh.
that he said, I couldn't wait to get out of there.
Oh my goodness. I've never been. It sounds amazing.
Me too. I've been there before. I've been there pre. I always like it. I think there's as much pain there as there is music in the walls. So it's a beautiful place. So those are the places you can find me. And anybody who wants to reach out to me sure should.
Yeah, totally they should. All right.
They should
Well,
read Young Americans and listen to the goddamn audiobook. It's really good.
yeah, that's right, guys. Don't forget that you can like check out the samples of that. It's like it's very convenient and wonderful.
Yeah, so even on iTunes, what the hell, peoples?
Nice.
Thank you so much for inviting me on here. I just love chatting with you.
I love chatting with you too. I'm so glad that you were able to squeeze it in because I know you got a crazy ass day. So,
It's gonna go blow up now.
yeah. Okay, well, you guys can follow me on Twitter as well at Elizabeth Amber and on Instagram at Amber Unmasked, which is mostly cat pictures, and Facebook, all that other stuff. But yeah, then don't forget to go to patreon.com/AmberUnmasked and contribute to my tip jar. That's really swell. So, anyway, this I think was the most awesome way to kick off the new year.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.